Jim Fester, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is the Southeast Asia Desk Correspondent for Executive Intelligence Review. He's been an associate of Lyndon LaRouche since 1972. He's a graduate of Trinity College in Hartford and completed two tours with the Peace Corps, first in Guyana and then in Thailand. He has a broad background in politics and recent history and current events, and I thought we might have a conversation about the economic situation, the bailout against the broader economic situation in the world, and discuss the ongoing campaign. His name, Michael Billington. Michael, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Pleasure to have you back. Why don't you give us your take on this bailout, which has undergone several transformations even since it was approved by the Congress and signed by Bush?
Well, this is yet another case, in this case the ultimate case, of the British takeover of the United States. This is an absolutely insane policy of effectively saying that the private banking institutions, these are global institutions, not only American institutions, really, the investment banks and the hedge funds and so forth, will be given full access, total control over the revenues of the United States of America in order to bail out the quadrillion dollar derivatives bubble, which is, in fact, absolutely useless, worthless paper, which has infected the commercial banking system in this country. And is now dragging not only the entire banking system down worldwide, but is creating the conditions for a cataclysmic collapse of the physical economy if this is not immediately reversed and imposed the solution LaRouche has made, the solution that Franklin Roosevelt used to defeat the collapse in the 1920s and 30s, which is to reassert American system policies, to recontrol the generation of credit, to take back into the hands of our elected government the power over the credit of our nation.
Well, just to step back a pace or two, Michael, my understanding, and probably most of the audience understanding, is that a lot of this is all related to the real estate bubble, where the price of real estate became grossly inflated and banks were lending, you know, mortgages that were really not justified by the value of the homes, and we got this massive form of inflation there. And that banks were making loans based upon presumed values, which didn't correspond to actual values, but more importantly, that they were creating new modes, new forms of equity or pseudo-equity in the form of these derivatives. I think it would be useful if you could expand
right.
on that, because
right.
most of us don't really understand derivatives.
Yes, creative accounting.
Creative accounting.
As they call it, yeah.
With
actually,
Enron, and then when Bush comes into office, he uses the same practice of telescoping profits to act as though the $3 trillion in projected surpluses were already money in hand in order to justify the $1 trillion cut for the rich.
Well, the mortgage bubble was not the cause of the problem. It was one of the results of the insane solution to the financial breakdown crisis that began way back in 1987. It was 1987, if people remember, I'm sure, that there was a cataclysmic stock market crash in October of 87, one which LaRouche had warned was coming. And at that time, it was the same time that Greenspan took over as Fed chairman. And at that time, they made the determination that in order to prevent that crash, which was the equivalent of the 1929 crash in the last depression, to prevent that crash from causing this breakdown crisis, they would print money with absolutely no limits. What Mr. Bernanke, who is known as Helicopter Ben, because his policy is that if you need to, you should go up in a helicopter and throw money out, which he's proving day after day now. But they began that process back in 87. That's when they created, they didn't create hedge funds, but hedge funds became basically totally deregulated, allowed to run amok amongst the United States. All British-based hedge funds, by the way, 80% of these hedge funds are registered in London.
The basic concept of a hedge fund is somehow hedging your bets?
Well, that's where the word came from, because derivatives supposedly were hedging things. But basically, they were just basically gambling institutions, unregulated. They They were created in order to say that these are run by such wise investors that there's no need for regulation. It's private money, but of course it's private money that is leveraged 20, 30 to 1, meaning that they take in $1 million from some rich George Soros type, and then they borrow 20 or 30 million against that and use the pool to speculate, to gamble, not to buy equity, not to buy anything productive, not to buy the piece of a factory or a farm, but to gamble on where you think real interest rates will be or where you think bond rates will be.
So if they're gambling with 30 million when they only actually have 1 million on hand, they could lose 29 million.
Yeah, that's called deleveraging. What you're seeing now in the financial system, that's what's happening, is that there's all of these breakdown crises. For instance, the creation of the head of the mortgage bubble was not the cause of the problem, but it was something created by the Greenspan crowd to do what you described, to create a new income stream of totally artificial money, lending to people that they knew couldn't pay it back, but they didn't give a damn. The point was that they wanted to create this short-term income stream that could then be sold off to suckers, and upon over which you could create new derivatives, mortgage-backed securities and other kinds of derivatives, to keep the pyramid going, to keep the Ponzi scheme going, when it was in fact breaking down way back in the 1990s, in the early part of the Bush administration. So this thing was created to solve the already existing breakdown of the banking system. And, of course, it just made the system worse. And what they're doing now is not only making it worse, this is creating a hyperinflation like 1923 Germany.
Now, Michael, before we go further forward, my impression is that since the Great Depression, roughly since the mid to late 30s, actually we had a lot of regulations and safeguards in place that were, however, rather systematically dismantled in recent times.
Right, precisely.
Where Phil Graham, for example, played a leading role, and Senator McCain was a staunch supporter.
Yeah, he and his wife, yeah. They were some of the people who made sure that derivatives remain unregulated. The Glass-Steagall Act, one of the many, many things that Roosevelt, FDR, in the 30s, put in place to make sure this kind of speculative bubble could never happen again, were systematically taken apart by Greenspan and a submissive Congress, a Congress which has proved itself to be utterly failures, both parties, and to have allowed the destruction of the guarantees against such a thing to be taken apart, and then lo and behold, voting for this insane bailout policy, which is doing what? It's taking this pool of derivatives, which LaRouche has consistently argued that we have to do what Roosevelt did in 32 when he 33 when he came in. Those worthless pieces of junk that have infected the banking system have to be just wiped out. You have to put the banks through bankruptcy protection in order to keep them alive. Let the hedge funds go. Let the investment banks go. But our chartered banks have to be saved, and they've been infected by this junk. And only a bankruptcy court can go in there and basically determine what represents absolute pure, worthless gambling debts and what we need to save in order to keep our physical economy going again.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Michael Billington. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let her into your heart. Then you can start to make it better. Hey Jude, don't be afraid. You were made to go out and get her. The minute you let her under your skin, then you begin to make it better.
host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is Michael Billington with the Lyndon LaRouche Organization. Michael is an expert on many subjects, and today we're talking about the bailout and the world economic situation, and then going to consider the campaign in that context. Michael, please do continue, and you might want to pick up by, you know, that definition of derivatives is still, I think, a little fuzzy in most of our minds.
Well, actually, let me encourage your listeners to call in, and we'll send you a copy of the EIR, which is going to be going, in fact, this week goes through this in some detail. But if
right.
you call,
that's the
can I give the number?
Intelligence Review magazine published by the LaRouche Organization.
Right. And the number is 1-800-929-7566. 929-7566, and we'd be glad to send you a copy of EIR and keep in touch. The point is that it's the only way to really explain it. There's many, many different kinds of derivatives, but the point is that they're simply gambling debts. They're bets placed upon where things in the real market are going to go, whether they'll go up, whether they'll go down, whether the interest rates will go up or down. And they're considered hedges so that, you know, you can hedge against losing a changing currency rate, for instance. They get various countries to place hedges against currency going the wrong way. Well, these are the kind of gambling so-called solutions to these kinds of problems, which are better solved by having fixed exchange rates. That's why Roosevelt had fixed exchange rates after the war, that you don't have money as a commodity. You shouldn't be allowed to use money as if it were a commodity. It's a political fiction made by governments whose purpose is to facilitate the real economy, physical economy, building industries, infrastructure, hospitals, schools, things needed for the general welfare. And we now have the exact opposite, which is that the general welfare, the productive power of our nation, is being not only sacrificed but decimated in order to maintain the power of a handful of global financial institutions that are utterly, utterly bankrupt. And there's only one way to deal with that, which is the way Roosevelt did, the way LaRouche has proposed it. Let me say, though, that I'm sure most of your listeners don't really know that there's a real revolution going on internationally, which is not being reported in the U.S. press, which is what you probably have heard is that all of a sudden everybody's talking about a new Bretton Woods.
Yeah.
This is suddenly on everybody's lips. Well, this, of course, is what LaRouche has called for many, many years, meaning a return to the Franklin Roosevelt policy of the Bretton Woods after the war, fixed exchange rates, no speculation on currency, long-term credits meant to facilitate industrial and infrastructural development in nations and in regions. So this is, of course, the only way out of this mess. Now, all of a sudden, now that the financial blowout has happened, and everybody recognizes that every wingding that Paulson and Bernanke and the British come up with lasts about 24 hours, and then everything collapses because everybody knows that basically this is a worthless pile of junk and you can't bail it out. But now everybody's jumping on the bandwagon and saying, oh, we need a new Bretton Woods, a new Bretton Woods. Well, some of this is very real. What's coming out of Russia, what's coming out of Italy, in Italy the government has adopted in LaRouche's name legislation that they say this is based on the policies of Lyndon LaRouche. And in France, Sarkozy, who came here last week and met with Bush and said we've got to have a new Bretton Woods conference next month. It's set for November 15th at this point. And then, lo and behold, Gordon Brown, the head of the British Empire, jumps in and says, we need a new Bretton Woods. Well, we call his version the Britain Woods.
Yeah.
It's the British Woods. What he's saying is, yes, we need a new world monetary system. We need a new IMF group of controllers who can basically deny sovereignty to nations throughout the world and have a group of central bankers who can impose bailout policies on each and every nation. Well, this is not going to happen. It's not going to happen because increasingly nations around the world recognize that the United States has become virtually captive to this British ideology, that we have to return to the principles that America once represented. And in a certain real sense, the principles of America and FDR are at this point more strongly supported within nations like Russia than they are within our own nation. And our congressmen, the complete capitulation of the Congress to this insane takeover by private banks of our nation's revenues is exemplary of the fact that we've had a complete failure of leadership. And around the world, people are influence has been in a fight to get them to recognize that without putting the U.S. back on its feet, without using the tremendous potential embedded in the American Constitution as a nation based on creditary principles, not monetary principles, but the idea that the government, elected government of the people, has power over its finances and its credit, not private banks, as unfortunately our Federal Reserve does.
Would a part of this reform involve dismantling the Fed?
Well, the Fed could be nationalized. It could be turned into the national bank that Alexander Hamilton had set up, or something along those lines. But as a private institution which controls our credit, absolutely, that has to be ended.
It has been shown to be not merely not constructive, but actually positively destructive.
Right, as the genius Alan Greenspan has proven. And by the way, I hope people know that Alan Greenspan, now that he's no longer our Fed chairman, went home to mother. He's now the official advisor to the British government.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And
you
know,
fairly stunning, isn't it?
It's what?
Fairly stunning.
No, it should be obvious, because that's what he always has been. He's always been an agent.
Seems the equivalent
of Palin
trade joining the Alaskan secessionist movement.
Now,
you're suggesting history is not going to look kindly on Alan Greenspan.
Well, this is real. You know, what the original bailout that Paulson designed was to buy up this toxic waste, this junk from the banks. And the British jumped in and said, wait a minute. Now, if you start trying to buy this stuff, if you set any price on it, then all of the banks who are holding this junk are going to have to write down the junk they hold to whatever price you end up paying. So don't do it. Just give the money to the banks. Give the taxpayers money to the banks. And I hope your listeners know the Federal Reserve policy right now is to give trillions of dollars, not only to American banks, but to the European banks, to the British. In fact, just yesterday, they pumped $1 trillion in between the United States and Europe, supposedly to save the money market funds. But over the last year, $3 trillion were pumped into European, British, Japanese, and American banks by you, the taxpayers of the United States.
The more I learn about this, the more nauseating it becomes. We'll be right back with my special guest, Mike Burlington. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. And I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today, Mike Billington, is an expert with the Lyndon LaRouche organization. Today we're talking about financial matters, the bailout, and the kind of scam it appears to be, and the deeper politics beneath the surface of these transactions. Michael.
Yes. Let me encourage people to go to our website. It's LaRouche PAC, P-A-C, LaRouchePAC.com. And I particularly encourage you to watch the videos that have been prepared by our LaRouche Youth Movement, whose purpose is to try to convey a sense of the real history of the United States. And in a country where people have, to a great extent, lost their ability to read constructively. They've used these videos as a way to locate the historic battle between the American system and the British system.
I'm worried Michael, that the American people have become so dumbed down, that they're so illiterate, not to say unscientific, have so little comprehension of these matters that they're suckers waiting to be fleeced, and that the organization is doing it.
Well, it's true. You can't romanticize the crisis we're in. A lot of the reason that we're in the mess we're in is because the population has been subjected to a cultural decay, which started, especially in the 1960s, the so-called 68er phenomena, the rock, drug, sex, countercultural morass, the Pepsi generation, the me generation. And in economics, it became, instead of a nation defined by the productivity of your workforce, it's the consumer society. It's what can you consume? Rather than what you can produce, what can you consume? And the cultural level has decayed so badly that you allow absolute degenerate leaders like we've had in the last 8 years, and as we have running for office today. You have a situation where both these candidates are completely supporting 100% the greatest treason in the history of the United States, the takeover of the revenues by these bankrupt banking institutions and the destruction of our commercial banking system and our physical economy.
Let me ask you, Michael, is the American taxpayer getting anything of value back for this $700 billion so-called investment?
No, of course not. You're getting looted. This is your money that's being thrown into a big sinkhole, and it's not $700 billion, as you know. That was just a figure picked out of thin air.
Yeah, potentially. It's
already trillion. Yeah, and there's a quadrillion dollars in these derivatives out there. That swamps the entire productive output of the world as a whole. The world financial system is clinically bankrupt, and we have to put it through bankruptcy again to save that which is productive, and especially our commercial banking system, from this plague, this cancer known as derivatives, known as the hedge funds, that again directed by London. So that's going to be tough to do, but here's the hope, which is that the rest of the world is waking up very rapidly. We have a situation where Bush was forced to agree to this November 15th Bretton Woods conference. Sarkozy is coming in fully supporting the Italian approach, which is LaRouche's approach. The Russians are almost fully committed to a return to the Roosevelt policy of great nations collaborating on basic infrastructure, on great projects as the foundation for a financial system which outlaws the kind of speculative lunacy that we've seen dominating our system and instead returns our financial system to that which basically serves growth and development and science and technology and the general welfare of the population here and around the world, and is based on the principle that we can work with nations around the world if we respect our own sovereignty and their sovereignty and work as a team of sovereign republics in the tradition of the Peace of Westphalia, which ended the last religious wars in Europe.
You know, Michael, I'm struck by your observation, which seems so obvious in retrospect, that a key element is to rigidify, to fix exchange rates between currencies. I mean, that seems like such a simple, obvious expedient. It's hard for me to imagine why it hasn't been the policy of the past.
Well, that was what happened in 1971. Remember, when Nixon was president, he had George Shultz, one of the most evil men of modern history, who was his Secretary of State. Or excuse me, he was Secretary of the Treasury at that time. He later became Secretary of State under Reagan. But as Secretary of the Treasury, he convinced Nixon to decouple the dollar from the international gold standard, to break the Bretton Woods, to allow currencies to float, to fluctuate, to become objects of speculation. And we watched the United States and then the world basically descend into this long process of deindustrialization. I met LaRouche at that time in 1971, and at that time he said, this is going to lead to a global depression, global warfare, sooner or later, if we don't turn it around. We're not going to be popular saying that to people who don't want to believe it, who want to believe that we can live on a debt pyramid. But when it happens, people around the world will turn around and say, okay, I see. I see who was telling us the truth when everybody else was lying. Now, what do we do to go back to a sane system of economy based on the principles that our founding fathers uniquely established in opposition to the British free trade model? And that's where we are today. And people are knocking on our door. LaRouche is now being publicly broadcast. The leading newspaper in Italy yesterday had an article called LaRouche and Tremonti, who was their finance minister, the new Bretton Woods. The Russians have had LaRouche on television 3 or 4 times in the last week. The French called the head of our French organization in to have a debate or discussion with the top economic advisor to their prime minister. Are you still there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I heard a click. So this is, even in the Philippines, there's articles in their leading paper saying it's time to listen to Linda LaRouche. This is spreading around the world. So what's going to happen on November 15th is a lot of people very knowledgeable about what LaRouche has done is going to come in here and basically tell the United States, look, we will work together with the U.S., but it's going to be on the basis of wiping out this phony derivative garbage and reestablishing what used to be known as the American system. And based on a Bretton Woods policy.
So there's actually a real possibility here because of this catastrophe of abolishing the Fed.
Well, I think in the long run that would be part of it, abolishing it or nationalizing it. We have to go back to a national banking system, not a central banking system.
Most Americans, of course, think that because it's called the Fed, that
it has something to do with the government.
It's national.
No, it's a private institution run by private bankers, and that's. Simply against our Constitution. Our Constitution doesn't allow that.
It's as national as Federal Express.
That's right. Yeah, so again, let me give the number, 1-800-929-7566. We have a lot of material that we're glad to send out to people to get them on board with this effort.
Let me ask you this, too, in the context of American history and all that. You know, McCain and Palin have been making allegations that I consider to be frankly absurd, that this is Obama's supporting socialist policies, when here you have a Republican president of the United States dumping $700 billion into these banks. According to Paulson, we're actually purchasing, preferred shares or stock in those banks. But any way you look at it, it's the federal government intervening to manage the economy in a big way. Not to mention, of course, everything else that goes along with that, a point to which we'll return after this break.
It's not socialist, though.
My special guest, Michael Billington, Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is a prominent member of the Lyndon LaRouche organization. He is an executive correspondent for the Executive Intelligence Review, and he has expertise across the board in many areas. His name is Michael Billington, and we're talking about the presumptive bailout and the politics that goes with it. Michael, I'm really glad to have you on to talk about these things. If there is this forthcoming new Bretton Woods conference, will Lyndon LaRouche personally be present?
Oh, no. This is going to be among heads of state. He'll be very much present, however, in the sense that I just indicated, which is that no longer are leaders of nations who have watched LaRouche closely and consulted with him and so forth hiding that fact. They're, in fact, putting it quite up front. Mr. Tremonti, who is the economics minister in Italy and who will be at that conference and who was at the recent conferences representing Italy along with their Prime Minister Berlusconi. But Tremonti has quite openly discussed with his leading newspapers not only in Italy but across Europe that the Bretton Woods idea, this actually came after Gordon Brown said that he was supporting a Bretton Woods, and Tremonti came out quite clearly and said, look, what Brown's talking about is not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is the Bretton Woods like that, devised by Roosevelt, and I learned of this through my long consultations with Lyndon LaRouche and meetings with Mr. LaRouche here and in Italy, and that this policy has to be based on the idea of eliminating the offshore havens, eliminating the derivative speculation, of returning to fixed exchange rates on currencies, and again, having control by sovereign states, by sovereign governments, not by private banks and international banking consortium, but by elected governments of sovereign states over their credit policy. That's what has been virtually, totally eliminated. And let me say, you mentioned at the end there's this talk about this being socialism and so forth. Socialism, as was tried in the Soviet Union, for instance, has proved to be ineffective, inefficient, doesn't work. But remember that it means the government controlling the means of production. What's happening here by this bailout of the banks is not taking control of the means of production, far from it. It's the banks taking control of government to make sure that no money goes into the means of production. The industry gets nothing, and that the banks get everything.
That's great, Michael. I love that. I was going to suggest that if we define, you know, capitalism in its pure free market form as implying that the government has no control, not even regulation of what happens in the markets and in business contexts, and then socialism, where the government has regulatory powers and partial control over the economy and the business sector, and communism, where the government has complete control, then of course it becomes obvious that practically every major nation in the world is a mixed economy involving a high degree of socialism.
Well, what's being promoted here is fascism. Classical fascism, as practiced by Mussolini, the founder of the Fascist Party in Italy, is banker dictatorship over the economy.
Yeah, you're talking about what's really going on here with the
banks.
That's
what's really happening.
Controlling the government. Yeah, I think that's extremely dangerous, and I couldn't agree more. But, you know, when Palin and McCain make these, actually, frankly, absurd allegations about socialism, I mean, it's not as though the Republicans weren't fully supportive of this $700 billion giveaway. And
they were not fully supportive. Remember what happened in this vote. It's actually important. The first vote was defeated, as you know.
Yeah.
Largely because there was an absolute outrage amongst the American people who were burning the tail of their congressmen. That's the proper treatment that they deserve.
I think 97% opposition. It was stunning.
Exactly. And a good portion of the Republicans, but it was not a Republican versus Democrat thing. A good portion of the Republicans voted against it, and about 90 Democrats voted against it.
Yeah.
And at that point, we know from our own intelligence sources that Obama was given a list of the Democrats that voted against this, and he threatened them. He said, if I'm going to be president, and if you don't vote for this, your career is through. Something along those lines.
This is news to me, Michael. I just said, go ahead.
That's the kind of thuggery that's been used by Pelosi, by
well,
their controller.
Well, I heard one representative went on the floor of the House and said that he or others were even told that if this didn't go through, that the president might impose a martial law.
Absolutely. And this is being discussed. They're now
stunning. I mean, how
training troops. An entire brigade of Iraq-trained soldiers are now being trained up at NORTHCOM to deal with potential riot control.
And what do you think is going to precipitate the need for their deployment?
It's the destruction of jobs. Look, people are losing everything they thought they had. People thought they had relative security in their jobs. They thought their children had a future. They thought they owned their homes, and so on and so forth. They're losing everything. If we don't provide them with a level of hope and direction that there are leaders in this nation who understand the needs of the general welfare, who want to return to a policy of production, of creating millions of jobs like Roosevelt did overnight, building the absolutely desperately needed infrastructure that this country needs and that the world needs. If we don't provide that kind of hope, and if you throw a population into chaos with no direction, you're going to end up with fascist thuggery and mobs and a French Revolution-style chaos.
Is Lyndon at all concerned about the theft of the election using electronic voting machines?
Well, yes, that's always been a problem. It clearly has happened in the past. And yes, that is that is something to be concerned about. But the bigger problem is that, to a certain extent, the election has become irrelevant because, in fact, you're not getting any opposition. It is worth saying that there are a number of people that the British and others are not so certain that McCain is totally under their control. I mean, he's pretty much just
He's just a loose cannon. I mean,
exactly.
The guy's completely unstable. He has no judgment. He's reckless.
He's detached
from reality.
But he has a number of people around him who are U.S. patriots, people from the military, from the intelligence community, and various economists who understand. These are Republicans, generally, who despise the neoconservatives, who despise McCheney and the Greenspan crowd.
Which is all completely justifiable, but, you know, if the neocons are the problem, I don't think John McCain is the solution.
Well, no, you're right. There's no solution out there other than, that's why I said it's almost irrelevant. But the fact is that this is going to be largely decided even before the next president takes office.
Well,
this is going to be fought out over these next few weeks and months.
Let me ask you a question which has, I think, an obvious answer. When McCain and Palin are belittling, you know, income redistribution, it's as though they are forsaking progressive in taxation.
But don't get caught up in this.
Medicare, Medicaid. I mean, this is one of the dumbest arguments I've ever heard from a
politician
in the last 50 years.
These arguments are irrelevant. It's posturing. It's sophistry. The problem that you have to look at most particularly is that George Soros still owns the Obama campaign lock, stock, and barrel. George Soros, the British agent, the man who brought the hedge fund phenomena into the United States, has bought this election. And this is a great danger to America. We're dealing here with a Democratic Party leadership which completely capitulated. The better people in the Congress from the Democratic Party, people who knew better, did not fight. The current issue of EIR has an article called "Is British Agent Soros Still Running Obama's Campaign?" by Jeff Steinberg and Tony Chaik. And I encourage you to call in. And again, you can call that number I gave you, 1-800-929-7566, and we'll send you a copy of this.
Michael, just to express a note of dissent. I mean, I don't know that to be the case. I'm just telling you what I do or do not know, you know, so that if I'm not arguing with you at this point about it, it's not because I agree with you.
Yeah, right.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Michael Billington. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.
You say yes.
Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today, Michael Billington, is with the LaRouche Organization and a correspondent for Executive Intelligent Review. He's been a longtime associate of Lyndon LaRouche, who graduated from Trinity College and served two terms with the Peace Corps. And we're talking about economic issues today, the bailout and all that. Michael, if it's good with you, we are going to take calls this second hour, and I want to give out the number. Is that agreeable?
Sure. I'll be on the next hour then. You weren't sure of that.
Yes.
Okay.
The call-in number is 866-582-9933. I repeat, 866-582-9933. And we already have a caller on the line, John from California. John, you're on the Dynamic Duo. John, are you there? Oh, did he? Okay. Well, listen, Michael, let me just say, perhaps John will call back, that I still think that it makes a difference which party is in office. You know, I used to talk about this at great length with Bush versus Gore and point out that, you know, Gore would never have withdrawn from the Kyoto Accords. He wouldn't stack the courts with right-wing judges. We almost certainly wouldn't have had a war. We might very well not have had a 9/11 if my research and that of others on that subject is correct, and a whole host of other issues. So, you know, I'm not convinced that there is no difference between the parties. I mean, just speaking for myself.
Well, we're not in a normal period of time. This is not, you can't look at the situation in the current or past geometry. We've gone through a phase shift in history of the most dramatic sort that anybody living today has ever, ever experienced. In fact, it's probably the greatest phase shift since the 1648 era that ended the 30 years of war.
And define the parameters of the phase shift.
The entire, at least the entire post-war era, which was predicated on Roosevelt's amazing transformation of this country from the depths of depression into one of the most massive productive powers the world had ever known.
Yes.
Which gave us not only basic industry, millions of jobs, infrastructure, electricity, power, and so forth, but it gave us the wherewithal to defeat the power of fascism that had been created in Europe by the British, financed by the British and some of their American friends, like Bush's grandfather, who helped finance the rise to power of Hitler. But that horrible force was defeated only because Roosevelt, in the midst of a depression, not as bad as the current crisis, but a very bad one, was able to unleash this tremendous productive potential from the American people, from the scientific and technological capacities of our scientists and our youth and so forth. That's built the base upon which we survived the last 60 years. And that is now totally destroyed by the speculative binge of the last 30 years, especially the last 8 years. We are either heading into a dark age, where you will see the population, the 6 to 7 billion population we have now, dwindle down to about the level that Prince Philip and his British oligarchs want, which is about 2 billion, through the various horsemen of the apocalypse, which we're already seeing unleashed on a global scale. War,
seriously?
So that's happening already.
You're talking about a depopulation on the order of 4 billion?
That's what Prince Philip has called for. He thinks that's what you need for the oligarchy to live comfortably. But this is remember what Prince Philip said. He said if he dies and gets reincarnated, he wants to come back as a deadly virus to help rid the world of the overpopulation. This is the Malthusian.
This is Prince Philip, the Queen's consort.
Yeah, that's him. And with Prince Philip and Prince Bernard.
This guy's some kind of monster?
It was Holland and the Holland royal family and the British royal family who funded and founded the World Wildlife Fund, which is the granddaddy of all of this anti-nuclear, anti-growth, anti-technology hysteria called the environmental movement, and which has been used by the likes of Al Gore with his global warming hoax to try to get people to accept British-style genocide under the guise of some sort of scientific hocus pocus.
Well, just to introduce a caveat, Michael, I mean, I happen to believe that global warming is bona fide, that it's principally caused by human activity, that this is a post-industrialization, virtually inevitable phenomenon unless we contain it. And, you know, I mean, I'm going to submit that my qualifications in this area are comparable to yours. I'll just offer that as a suggestion. I have a PhD in the history and the philosophy of science. I've published 28 books, 150 articles, and I care about this kind of thing, okay? So I don't accept that global warming is a myth. I don't accept it. I think that what Al Gore has been doing is heroic, and I think it's exactly right on, and that his film, for example, An Inconvenient Truth was a very Herculean effort to explain to the American people what's going on from the point of view of ecology and evolution, evolution having been the subject of two of my last three books.
Well, it's genocidal, Jim. If this is implemented, if the policies of stopping technological development, because technological development enhances more global warming and therefore it has to be stopped. Remember that the underlying all of this is the argument that the undeveloped sectors of the world, China and India in particular, must agree not to industrialize the way the United States has, because if they do, then it would be creating such global so-called pollution, and of course carbon dioxide is not a pollutant, but that's what they call it, that it would create such a problem that it would somehow all the oceans would rise and everybody would die. This is patently false. It's a genocidal policy implemented by the Anglo-Dutch financial institution.
Well, I'm sure we do agree that there are limits on economic development, that you cannot have indefinitely sustainable policies of growth because you're consuming more and more natural resources.
Okay, now you're getting to the key issue of the American system. The key issue of the American system was the refutation of that notion, the Malthusian notion that the British based their policy on, that said, we are limited by resources to accepting a limit on population and a limit on development. Therefore, you should allow the British to run industry, and you should be an agricultural nation and let us control you. The point is, we are not animals. the level of
which are known as laws
baboons.
Of nature. Which are known as laws of nature of physics, chemistry, biology,
yes.
and so forth.
And our capacity to discover those higher laws means that we redefine our resource base. Animals can't do that. Baboons could never reach billions of people because they have to live the way their great-grandparents lived. We don't. When we discover the laws of nuclear fusion, we transform our resource base. We no longer have to depend upon relatively limited resources of oil and coal that would be better used for plastic and things. Anyway,
now
we can
all
use
all the features of cultural evolution plug in because we're creating artifacts and products and new arrangements of social organization and new modes of productivity and all that, which gives us tremendous potential, Michael, but for bad as well as good, meaning a lot of what we do can be very harmful, as I would submit a tremendous amount of our carbon-based technology is ultimately doing enormous damage to the environment.
Well, again, as I said, nuclear fission, nuclear fusion are not carbon-based, first of all. They utilize, you know, uranium and then seawater for fusion as their fuel base.
And we don't even know what to do with the waste, unless we turn it into a depleted uranium, which is an inhumane weapon that we've been using all over Iraq, and it has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, for God's sake.
People very much need to write in, to call in, and get our material on this.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Michael Billington. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.
Is the GCN Radio Network, home to hard-hitting talk radio.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is with the Lyndon LaRouche Organization. His name is Michael Bennigan, and he's at Billington, and he's an expert on many different areas. Right now we're in the context of a discussion of the bailout and the economy against the background of some differences between us, but of course I'm interested in having his views presented here as opposed to my own over whether global warming is a bona fide phenomenon to which humans have contributed significantly, which I answer in the affirmative, but he denies, and where I continue to believe there are significant differences between the parties, but where Michael is suggesting, and this will be a good place for us to resume our conversation, that recent events are so overwhelming that they make the differences between the parties really minuscule in comparison to the broader picture of economic change.
Let me say on the whole global warming thing, rather than sort of arguing about it here, I just strongly encourage people to call in 1-800-929-7566 and say you'd like to get some of our material, our scientific material. We publish a magazine called 21st Century Science and Technology, which answers these questions in great detail.
Okay, good.
By the way,
we do have a caller, Michael, which we'll take. John from Canada. John, are you there?
Yes, I am, Jim. Hi.
Please, hi. Yes, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I've called in before, but I'm not on this topic. And I'm sorry I didn't get your guest name. I just tuned in kind of late.
Michael Billington.
Right, and I didn't get the number down, I originally was a believer in the theory of global warming as presented by Al Gore and the one that you're espousing. And I was turned around on that primarily from watching originally a series of documentaries. But originally, if you do go to Google Video and just search global warming, I don't know if you've seen these, Jim, yourself. I doubt that you have, because I think your faith would be shaken if you did. But
the global warming swindle.
The great global warming swindle, for one.
Well, let me tell you a little where I'm coming from. I spent the last 10 years, I retired 2 years ago, but the last 10 years of my 35-year teaching career was involved doing a graduate course where we we're assessing the moral caliber of the United States in terms of all of its policies, economic, tax, and all this kind of thing from a moral standard. And I was team teaching it with the first PhD in ecological economics in the country, along with a biologist with an extensive background in evolution. And we discussed this stuff a great deal. I'll just say, this is not a casual opinion of mine, plus my interest in evolution and ecology, where I mentioned that two of my last three books are on evolution, is quite significant. The idea you could have an industrial evolution that generates this huge amount of energy into the atmosphere and not have it bring about significant environmental effects is just absurd on its face. And I'm glad, you know, you mentioned this other stuff out there. I really only wanted to define my position in relation to Michael's, lest my silence be interpreted as assent. I mean, that was the sole reason, really, for me stating my view.
Well, I hear you, Jim, and you've stated that view a number of times in the past on the program, and I probably wanted to speak up at that time because you seem to be adopting the attitude that you urge people not to adopt on, say, video fakery. You say, keep an open mind, look at the evidence. You changed your mind on that.
No.
Yet you seem to be
all I mean to say is here in this context, I really wasn't trying to draw Michael into a debate on it. I was just trying to define what my position is today. I welcome your suggesting that I look at additional, and it's entirely possible that, you know, if I found this evidence persuasive, that it would affect my attitude. So, I mean, your point's impeccable.
Jim and John?
Mm-hmm.
Let me approach it a different way, if I can, all right?
Go ahead. Let's
look at a couple of the implications of the global warming stuff. One, the entire ethanol operation, which I think is now, first of all, it's collapsing. Basically, all of the people that invested in these wild ethanol schemes, diverting food into basically burning food for an inefficient form of fuel, these things are economically just collapsing on their face. Why you don't hear about it much anymore. And yet you've got these laws in the books that say you have to produce this much ethanol in a world which is starving.
Of course we can have a real problem and that not be the solution.
Yeah.
Well, it could be that that's not the solution.
But that's why I'm saying
food for fuel is a mistake. Yeah.
So this is one level. And then the irony, of course, that the people promoted Gore and others promoting their solutions of deindustrialization and forced backwardness as their solutions to this non-existent problem. It's interesting that they don't promote nuclear power. And one of the things that convinced some of the heads, the guy that was head of Greenpeace and a few others to basically bolt from this whole movement was their refusal to support nuclear power development, which of course produces no carbon, no
But Michael, there is that disposal problem I raised, and suggest that I was, just off base and talking about depleting.
It's not a problem. There's no waste, Jim. There's no waste in nuclear power.
4.5 billion years.
Jim, there's no waste in nuclear power. The waste, if you have reprocessing facilities, if you can transform that stuff into more fuel, you can use breeder reactors and other forms, you end up with virtually nothing left. It's not a problem. It's a political issue which has been used. Let me give you a key example from my personal experience. I run our Southeast Asia work. I do a great deal of work in the Philippines. When President Ferdinand Marcos was overthrown in 1986, he was overthrown by George Shultz, the same man we discussed already, who gave us the end of the Bretton Woods, and who his deputy Secretary of State at the time was Paul Wolfowitz, whom you all know very well.
Alas.
The architect of the Iraq War and so forth. Their policy, and Wolfowitz's entire life, was based on stopping developing countries from having peaceful nuclear power on the excuse that third world people can't be trusted, they're going to use them to turn them into bombs. Now, this was their public excuse, but the real purpose was that this is British imperial policy. Keep the world in a state of backwardness in order to control it. Keep them fighting each other over ethnic, religious, territorial issues in order to be able to control the world economy. And what happened in the Philippines is that they succeeded through various means of getting the population to think they were doing away with the dictator when, in fact, they were slitting their own throat at behest of Shultz and Wolfowitz and Kissinger and others to shut down the Marcos administration, shut down a nuclear plant that was completely done, ready to be turned on. It was shut down, mothballed, it never produced a single watt of electricity, and the country has never survived from the destruction of that and other industrial and agricultural programs that Marcos had progress. But under this early neocon crowd, we began to see the implementation of British deindustrialization and backwardness as a policy in order to implement the financial controls at the top, a financial dictatorship through the international financial institutions, which succeeded in destroying that country. It's still an abomination. And it has to be reversed. Finally, it is, largely because of our work. They're now talking, finally, of reopening that nuclear plant in the Philippines.
John, why don't you stand by and continue this conversation after the break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest, Michael Billington. We'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today, Michael Billington, is with the Lyndon LaRouche Organization. We've been talking about a variety of issues, mostly economic, and here we're talking now a little bit about evolution, ecology, and global warming. And on the phone we have John from Canada. John, let me just say, I appreciate your calling in, you know, to raise this issue, because if there is new evidence or alternative hypotheses that I haven't previously considered in relation to global warming, then that's certainly something I need to take a look at.
Well, Jim, on these documentaries, they have a number of scientists, and they happen the key two or three of the key people who are on the Great Global Warming Swindle documentary, which is the first of these I saw, are scientists from Canada, one from one of the universities in Ottawa, another from a university in Winnipeg, University of Manitoba, and they come across as very credible. There are other scientists there as well. And the biggest example, the most shocking one to me, was when they show an excerpt from the Al Gore film with his famous, you know, he draws those lines of the trend line of the connection between increases in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and increases in temperature.
Mm.
And they point out, and they show the way Al presents it in the film, and they say, yes, in fact, there is a correlation, and it actually, it does look just like that. Unfortunately, what Mr. Gore doesn't point out to you is that the correlation is exactly the opposite of what he suggests. The temperature goes up, and then the carbon dioxide concentration goes up afterwards. That's what
the higher temperatures.
That's what the data actually shows. So it has been presented to show the exact opposite of what it does in fact show.
This is a reversal of cause and effect in terms of the way the correlation is displayed?
No, it's the same. Well, Gore says, look at these things. They are connected, cause and effect. And he says, look at this, how the temperature, carbon dioxide is going up. And then look at this, temperature is going up. See this correlation? But they say what he doesn't point out to you is that, in fact, the correspondence in time is the opposite of what he's suggesting to you.
So we can't have the effect
the temperature
before the cause.
Right? Well, right. So, in fact, it's tending to show that something else is causing the temperature to go up, and then carbon dioxide goes up later.
And what is that something, do you suppose, that's causing the temperature to go up?
Well, those scientists are suggesting that it is changes in sun activity that account for the by far the largest portion of any change in climate.
Are you concerned with the decimation of the rainforests in Brazil, turning them into a gigantic parking lot, that's going to have an effect on the capacity of humanity to inhabit the Earth?
Yeah, that's I think you'd agree as a philosopher, that's not an appropriate argument. I am definitely concerned about those things. I think there are other reasons to cut down on the burning of fuels that create pollution in cities, for example. There may be all sorts of other nasty things. What I'm not in favor of is lying. And I'm not in favor of lying into. Once I discovered that the media and many people with university degrees and in great foundations and such are telling lies about very important topics that you spend a lot of time investigating and you've done heroic work on, once I discovered that they can tell massive lies about things, I then open my mind, what else are they lying about? And global warming is a topic on which the media is almost universally, the critics of the global warming hypothesis can't get a tiny bit of exposure.
The recommendation, John, is that if we want to take a look at this more recent work on global warming, we should view a video available on the Internet, The Great Global Warming Swindle, correct?
Yes, and there's a couple others.
Anything else in particular you'd like to emphasize, or is that a good place to begin?
Well, that's a good place to begin, but it's not to say that you draw the conclusion that, therefore, pollution is good or anything like that. But a starting point, you just have to open your mind. Once you say, if they're lying to me about basic facts, then, you know, I have to look further and think, why are they lying to me about this?
Yeah.
And what is the truth? But it doesn't necessarily mean that I think it's great that everybody should drive Hummers or any crazy thing like that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Michael, you say that you'd like people who are concerned about this question.
Two things. One is that I should mention to John that we did interviews with, I think, four of the leading scientists who produced that documentary, which is indeed quite powerful. And we did the interviews in EIR, which can be found on our archives. We also published a report, which we could also send out to anybody that called, called Covered in Gore. And it's an entire pamphlet on on gore, on the fact that
Give
gore
us the
is
number
environmental.
Again. Give us the number again, Michael.
The number is 800-929-7566.
7566.
Right.
And the one on global warming covered with gore?
Yeah, if you call in, we'll send you that. It's called Covered in Gore, yeah.
In Gore, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Good.
Well, look, I should get off the line and let
you
carry on with Michael.
I'm glad you called. You call again.
And let me just add to what John said, is that one thing is unrefutable, which is that the biggest lie of all the lies is that there is a consensus on global warming. It's an absolute total lie. There are the majority of scientists, climatologists, geophysicists, and others know that this is not man-made, and they have argued vociferously, and as John pointed out, they simply have not been given the press, which is controlled by the financial institutions, who want to implement those policies for totally other reasons, but find it convenient to say that we have to stop growth because of the global warming problem.
Well, even the scientific knowledge of our time is both tentative and fallible. Tentative meaning it's subject to revision with the acquisition of new evidence and new alternative explanations.
Fallible
in the sense that even if it's well supported at the time, that doesn't guarantee that it's true. So I certainly concede John's point that in principle I must be open-minded to the possibility that even the views that I have taken to be well established about global warming might turn out to be mistaken.
Right.
Great.
So, thanks
for opening your mind up again, Jim. Bye for now.
Well, I appreciate your calling.
Take care.
Well said. Michael, let's see.
Yes.
Where shall we go from here? I mean, I'm very interested in taking advantage of your presence here to.
Well, I wanted to return to the issue of this Bretton Woods conference.
Right.
And to something an important aspect of this, which is that, again, most Americans don't know what the hell is going on in Russia. They've been fed all of this malarkey about what happened when this guy Saakashvili in Georgia launched his assault against South Ossetia, a Pearl Harbor-type sneak attack against the Russians who were under a UN mandate protecting South Ossetia, were under attack by this fanatic, this guy Saakashvili, and the Western press reported this as Russia attacking the sovereign state of Georgia. Well, it was the opposite.
Right.
It was George Soros' creation, Saakashvili, who launched
Let's pick up here, Michael,
and
when
we'll
come back from the break. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest, Michael Billington. We'll be right back. Your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where Kevin can be found here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week, concluding an interesting conversation with Michael Billington of the LaRouche Organization, who recommends that you call an 800 number, 929-7566, to obtain copies of the Executive Intelligence Review, the LaRouche publication, on a variety of subjects. Michael, I wish we had more time than just this one segment remaining.
Well, this is the, let me go to the heart of the matter then. What happens next month on November 15th could very well determine the fate of civilization. That sounds very dramatic, and it is. What LaRouche has said, and this is also contained in the EIR you can get if you call in, is that if this conference is to take place, and if it's going to be successful, it has to be on the basis of the Peace of Westphalia, which was the 1648 agreement that ended the 30-year war, the religious wars in Europe, which was predicated on the basis that the nation's self-interest is located in the interest of the other, that sovereignty is not a matter of one nation against another, but it's the power of one nation to be self-governing in the context of recognizing the interests of all nations as being in the interests of your own. And he is very explicit that the basis upon which the decisions that are to be reached on the 15th and possibly on subsequent meetings has to be predicated on that, the most fundamental basis upon which Western civilization was founded and thrived and is now collapsing. The particular key that's required for the November 15th meeting is that there be a pre-agreement between the United States and Russia. LaRouche has posed what he calls the four-power agreement, that if we are to have a new world monetary system to get out from under this wreck before we head into a new dark age, it's going to require that Russia and China and India, as the three great powers, great nations in size and population of Eurasia, and the United States, those four powers, come to an agreement on both putting the existing bankrupt global financial system through bankruptcy proceeding in order to eliminate the junk, the speculative waste, and to restore a banking system predicated on investing in long-term real growth of the productive powers of labor through industry, infrastructure, agriculture, and so forth. And to do that, we have to recognize, we in America have to recognize, that in Russia today, under Putin, Medvedev, and their foreign minister, Mr. Sergei Lavrov, there is a virtual campaign on amongst their own people and amongst the world to support the ideas of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. As Lavrov put it, the world desperately needs the America of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I wish we'd heard those words today in our Congress, but we don't. But it's the basis upon upon which an agreement can be made between the United States and Russia as the most important of the three powers of Eurasia, which, if that is made, China and India will certainly agree and go along, that we must establish again a basis of great projects, investing in things like the Eurasian Land Bridge, the so-called New Silk Road, building the Bering Strait Tunnel between Russia and Alaska as a way of literally connecting Russia and North America by rail, a dream that goes back to Henry Carey, Lincoln's economist, in the 19th century, who wanted to wrap the world with iron the way Lincoln built America and the cross-continental railroad with railroads as a basis not just from getting to one end to the other, but of opening up the interior to great cities, to agriculture and industrial development. These great ideas are the great ideas of the America, the founding fathers, who fought against the British free trade model, what we now call globalization, imperial policies, and instead locate in the creative power of the human mind that capacity to transform the discovery of great principles into machine tools, into technologies, which can enhance the standard of living and the quality of living of every human being on Earth. This is what's before us today. Either a descent into a horrible hell, a global war, and a dark age, or to take advantage of this crisis, which now everyone must acknowledge, to do what we should have done all along, but which often takes this level of crisis to get people to wake up to the fact that they have to think like human beings again about transforming the world along the lines of that great creative potential that we have as a human race created in the image of God.
Well, Michael, it's fascinating to see FDR coming back into the scene again as representative of appropriate solutions to serious problems, because certainly American history reflects that he bore that role, and now you're suggesting that that his solutions may be beneficial for world history as well.
Exactly. It was then. Remember that it was both his refusal to buckle to the British-run financial raiding that had gone on against America and the world in the 20s. First thing he did was to close the banks, the banker holiday. All the banks had to be audited and the junk thrown off. Those that were viable after that, the government helped, but only in the sense that they issued credits through the banks, which were tied. They were directed credit, as it was called, that the banks could get these credits from the government if they agreed that they were going to go into things needed by the nation, agriculture, industry, infrastructure, schools, hospitals, and so forth. Not speculation, not building casinos, not building whorehouses. So that is that idea of the American government being a centralized government which directs in the name of the people. The elected representatives control the direction of credit in order to facilitate private entrepreneurs who therefore have access to skilled labor, to energy, to water, to power, because the government assures that these basic things are made available to the private entrepreneurs and to the citizens at large. This is the principle, the credit principle of American system versus the British parliamentary system, which has to be the basis upon which we can restore a world of the sort that our forefathers foresaw, not only for Americans, but for the entire world. This is our opportunity to bring that about.
Well, you made this rather important terminological point that when the corporations are running the government, you have a fascist arrangement. When the government is managing or regulating or governing the corporations, I presume that that might be characterized as socialism in some sense, but it's certainly a positive virtue in terms of the relationship between the government and the population.
In fact, Mussolini called his fascism a form of corporatism.
Yes.
Although it's wrong to think of it just as corporations per se, it's really the banks. The point is that the banks running that policy, just as banks have generally taken over our corporations by allowing hedge funds and other kinds of speculators to buy out our corporate structure.
It does sound to me, when you talk about, fixing the exchange rate and so forth, and putting controls on, you know, speculation on money and so forth, that we may be acknowledging that perhaps Marx had a point in suggesting that, you know, using money alone to make money, it was a risky proposition and perhaps not in the best interest of a population.
Well, he wasn't the only one who warned against usury.
Yeah.
It started long ago in the Bible.
All right, this is something about money changers.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Michael, I don't understand today why, you know, all this greed still runs rampant, especially in Republican circles, as though they have never heard that it's more difficult for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than it is for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle, or that a rich man should give all his money to the poor. We don't hear that anymore.
Yeah. It's cultural, Jim. This is what happened, and this is the nature of tragedy. That's why LaRouche talks so much about classical tragedy. Tragedy is not about a tragic figure who screws up his country or something. It's about a population which tolerates backwardness, which becomes culturally depraved, and therefore is incapable of living up to the principles that the nation was found on. And
Mike,
this is the challenge to it today.
Great having you on. I think you have so much that's important and fascinating to discuss. I look forward to having you back, and I want to thank you so much.
Okay, thanks a lot. It's good to be here.
A real pleasure. Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. I'll repeat that number one last time, 800-929-7566. Give it a call. Your host, thank you all for listening.
All right. All right.